From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how the threat and anxiety of the COVID-19 pandemic is being felt by people fighting addiction. Pregnancy in the time of coronavirus has expectant mothers looking for alternatives to hospital delivery. And we hear from San Antonio Congressman Lloyd Doggett, chairman of the House Ways and Means Health Subcommittee, about the federal government's response to COVID-19.
Well, unfortunately, I think our choice is 6 feet apart or 6 feet under, and it really comes down to that.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. For people fighting addiction or those in recovery, changes in routine can threaten their sobriety. And as more and more cities and counties in Texas issue shelter-in-place orders to stop the spread of COVID-19, people's routines are being turned upside down. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame reports on how some folks in recovery are trying to make it work.
A screen full of faces. A scene that's becoming common everywhere. This Zoom meeting's full of students from San Antonio's Our Lady of the Lake University. They're now meeting online as part of a fellowship for people recovering from alcohol and substance abuse.
So I'll just welcome everybody. If you could please join me in a moment of silence, after which we'll recite the Serenity Prayer.
Rebecca Gomez, the meeting chair, starts them off. Their voices echo in virtual space.
God, grant me the serenity. To accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can.
One thing they definitely can't change is COVID-19. Gomez says addiction thrives in situations like this.
The isolation of that really feeds the disease and continues to keep people from being able to get healthy.
For everyone in this meeting, daily life had been disrupted, connections changed, and sobriety tested.
My name is Lydia. I'm an addict.
Lydia.
Well, I was late. I had some serious technical difficulties. I had literally had to pull out another computer just to make this happen.
It's been a difficult few weeks for Lydia Hamner. Since the COVID-19 outbreak, the PhD student lost her job waiting tables at the San Antonio Riverwalk. Her other work as a mental health awareness trainer was put on hiatus until April. She tells the group she's afraid about not being able to support her family.
In this period of adapting and adjusting, my stress and my depression recently, I've been like, I woke up and I want a drink.
Hamner says she's able to manage those urges by remembering everything she's accomplished sober. Though with San Antonio's new rules about staying home, many of her tools for managing stress and staying connected are off limits.
In my recovery, I go to church on Sunday. That's my stronghold, right? So I can't do that right now.
The gym is out too. Hamner's found herself in a lot of online meetings in her newfound free time, which helps to a point.
So I think it's been really challenging for me to really accept the fact that, I have to find ways at home to look inward instead of, giving all my power to other things to make me happy, right? I need to find it within myself.
Individuals are, seeking to self-medicate and deal with the triggers and their relapse episodes that they're feeling.
Abigail Moore is the CEO of the San Antonio Council on Alcohol and Drug Awareness. Community, she says, is a huge part of people's drug and alcohol recovery. And she says COVID-19 is even deterring some people from seeking help.
Well, they're not showing up because, of what they're seeing on the news and they're scared. So, we're seeing a drastic drop of people either entering treatment, the ones that are currently registered to begin the process, or the ones that are participating in outpatient programs.
Now Moore's organization is trying to build more online recovery communities and make sure certain telehealth and counseling services get covered by insurance.
Do we have any announcements, anything that I need to...
In the Our Lady of the Lake virtual meetup, social work student Van Cormier tells the group he's newly sober from alcohol and drugs and says he's now navigating sobriety with just his cell phone, the big book, and online recovery groups.
I went to the grocery store the other day. I had this two different times I was stopped purchasing alcohol. I don't know if, the stress of what we're dealing with, that was a reason to want to get the alcohol, but it didn't happen. I'm still sober from it.
Cormier says he's simply taken his normal routine virtual so he can stay accountable to others. And he thinks this is a tough journey, no matter what.
I wouldn't say what's going on right now outside is any more different than any other day. I mean, I guess sobriety is subject to relapsing at any time, not just because there's a virus out there.
In that way, he says the cornerstones of recovery are the same things that'll help all of us during the coronavirus outbreak. Connectedness, acts of service, and routine. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
New rules at many hospitals around birthing aim to limit new moms' exposure to COVID-19. Those rules, combined with outright fear of the disease, have some pregnant moms looking for alternatives to the hospital. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flab brings us this report.
Nikki MacGyver Brown's phone's been ringing a lot more lately.
Here's one here. She is calling about the coronavirus.
The certified nurse midwife sits in an exam room. A sticker on her open laptop reads, "Midwife at your cervix." She plays a message from a recent call.
I am 4 months pregnant and currently being seen at a doctor's hospital who had an outbreak of corona and is now closed, and I am looking to transfer care to a home birth or birth center.
Brown owns San Antonio Nurse Midwife Birth Center in Garden Ridge, north of San Antonio. She's getting double the 10 calls she usually gets a week as women concerned about COVID-19 look at birthing centers and home births.
Probably about 70% are about COVID and 30% are about the support people.
Most are worried about hospitals exposing them to the disease, while everyone else doesn't like recent rule changes limiting the number of people allowed at the birth. At many hospitals, you could have two people with you as you give birth, your partner and your birthing coach, like a doula or a parent. Now, at many Texas hospitals, it's just one.
So it's really causing a lot of them to become anxious, and it is wrecking their plans.
Set among green fields and foggy skies, the feel of the home-turned-birthing center is about as far from what you could imagine an urban hospital to be. They have two birthing suites, and Brown often does home births. She says she delivered 59 babies last year. As we talk, a woman pulls up outside. Brown calls her.
I see ya. I was gonna,
Hi.
I was going to ask your questions while you were in the car. You ready?
Okay.
The physical checkup will be face-to-face, but to limit exposure, they started doing the check-in interview outside.
You can. Tell me about that call.
That was a cough.
I know.
I'm just clearing my throat. I haven't been outside of my house for 2 weeks.
Dr. Shirsi Agard says the hospital is the best place for all moms to give birth.
We've got decades of data outside of COVID-19 saying it is safer for women not to give birth at home.
She's a professor of obstetrics at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston and says many women are asking questions about how COVID-19 could impact their pregnancy or birth.
We simply don't know. We wish we could tell everybody, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. But we don't know that yet.
Now flu season is looking like a trip to Disneyland because this is just outrageous.
Claudia Quinto lives in San Antonio and is 35 weeks pregnant. She plans on giving birth in the hospital, but COVID is complicating that plan.
And if I get too stressed, it could, you know, activate labor. And we're still 4.5 weeks away.
She self-quarantined the past 15 days, only venturing out for checkups. And she had hoped to have her husband and her sister in the room when she gave birth. Her hospital says her sister can't be there.
It's a little bit heartbreaking. At this point, she won't even be able to see him until she's been away from people for 14 days.
And there's an outside chance that hospitals could further restrict who can be in the room. When asked what she would do if she had to birth with no emotional support people, she said she didn't know, but she would probably still go to the hospital. Her husband, Joey Quinto, a nurse, says if he has a vote, it's for the hospital.
I know her answer is maybe yes, maybe no, but for me, it would be a definite yes, because if there is anything that happens, you know, any kind of emergency, she's already at a place where they can perform those types of things.
Hospitals in Texas are still able to keep pace with cases of COVID-19, but if the curve isn't flattened and hospital beds become scarce, it's not clear what that will mean for moms. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
The United States is now the new global epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak and now leads the world in confirmed cases. As of late Thursday, more than 82,000 people have been identified as infected, and nearly 1,200 people have died in the U.S. The U.S. House of Representatives passed on Friday a historic $2 trillion emergency relief bill called the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. San Antonio Congressman Lloyd Doggett is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Health. The Democrat has been vocal in trying to keep unnecessary corporate bailouts out of the bill and has focused on providing medical care, COVID-19 testing, and economic relief to working families who have lost jobs and wages due to the shutting down of businesses.
My goal is to help those who are most impacted. So we worked in our previous bill to assure that everyone can get free corona testing. Unfortunately, because of the delays, and contrary to the promise that tests would be available today, tomorrow, beautiful test in the words of the president, I'm told that for most people who do not have serious symptoms, those tests won't be available till June or July. But we're doing all that we can to get the test available and meet that false claim as soon as possible. I've been working with the Small Business Administration and my colleagues to try to assure that disaster-type loans of the type that came out of after Hurricane Harvey are promptly available. We have some additional relief for small business so that many of these loans are forgivable if they keep their staff, their employees online, they keep them working. Then there is the need for the many people who have already been laid off, more unemployment claims than we've seen in Texas in decades, and trying to assure that there is unemployment assistance.
So you are the chairperson of the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee. That puts you in a significant role in trying to deal with a lot of the pharmaceutical part of what we're dealing with.
Yes, as you know, we visited in previous months about my efforts to try to get some control over the monopoly power of Big Pharma. So I was very displeased with the way this big $2 trillion bill came out of the Senate without restraints on Big Pharma, and with about another $3.5 billion, total of what will ultimately be more than $7 billion in taxpayer money going into vaccines with no assurance that people will be able to afford those vaccines, no protection for the uninsured.
To the uninsured, I know that you have been a leading voice in calling for a reopening of the Affordable Care Act for people to sign up during a big health crisis like we have right now.
Yes, once again, not unlike a fact that the administration opened this after some of the natural disasters, Hurricane Harvey and the like, they could open up an enrollment period right now so that the 1 million estimated Texans, actually 1.1 million, who would qualify for a no premium, no cost to them of health insurance protection, and many more who could jettison these junk plans that were being sold and get more comprehensive insurance, that would all be an opportunity. This administration seems ideologically opposed to that. We had every Democrat in our delegation call for that, also call for Governor Abbott to get involved and help us open that up so that we wouldn't have the distinction of being the state with the most uninsured population at a time that everyone needs access to a family physician.
Are you concerned that there is profiteering from big or pharma or other industries during this crisis?
I am concerned, and I'm concerned about the potential in the future, since at the moment there is not a cure or a new treatment and not a vaccine. There's no more monopoly power profiteering than usual. When those new cures and treatments that we hope come out and the vaccines come out, the technology is great. It's paid for by the taxpayer. But we all know that an unaffordable drug or vaccine is 100% ineffective. One of the other things I mentioned that a big pharma got into this legislation, which appears to be favorable to consumers but is very limited, is guaranteed coverage. There is a requirement if you have insurance that the insurance company has to provide the vaccine and cannot require a copayment, which sounds good, but it also destroys any lobbying, any leverage that the insurer has to have affordable prices. And so ultimately, we'll end up paying for monopoly prices through our premiums, even though those of us who have insurance may be able to get a vaccine. So this remains a problem, of course, for the uninsured who have no protection, and we have so many uninsured neighbors in Bexar County.
So when there's a vaccine and it becomes generally available for COVID-19, is it going to be kind of like, I remember when I was a kid and everyone lined up at the local high school and we all got our polio shot?
Me too.
We didn't have to pull out credit cards or shell out any money. This was something that was done to provide the public for everyone's health.
Well, that's the way it should be. And it should be government purchase of those at a reasonable price so that the pharmaceutical or vaccine maker makes a profit, but not an extortionate price. And it should be available to everyone. I'm sure that many people long for that vaccine, but the president has made a false promise in suggesting it's just around the corner. The medical experts I talk to say we're looking at a year to 18 months without any vaccine. So we go not only through the current crisis, but this may reoccur in the fall in the next round of coronavirus without any vaccine. I think that initially there may be a limited supply. We need to be sure that we're cooperating with other countries and we're getting the best possible expertise and that we're sharing this information. So this isn't a race to control a limited supply with a monopoly patent, but that this is shared research in which we try to help people in Bexar County and around the world.
So we still don't have the test, and certainly we know we don't have enough ventilators.
Yep.
Could that be remedied?
Well, it could have been remedied by proper preparation from President Trump and by his invoking and using the Defense Production Act. He has not done that, and it's really difficult to believe that we're not having significant new production of ventilators, which are vital, and of course of test kits. Only weeks ago, I was complaining to Trump's Commerce Department because they sent out a bulletin encouraging American companies to ship some of the protective gear and equipment to China instead of keeping it here at home where we need it. I think the administration had no hesitancy about doing that, but they have been reluctant to order companies to produce the equipment and that we need. I'm delighted that there, you know, are companies right there in San Antonio that are beginning, like Artisan Distillery, to produce some hand sanitizer. But we also need companies, whether they're willing to do it voluntarily or not, that have expertise in equipment to produce the ventilators that can be life-saving.
There is a pharmaceutical company, Gilead. They received a orphan drug designation for a treatment that they're developing for COVID-19. And then there was an outrage, and then they rescinded that request. But it had been granted by the FDA. Can you kind of explain what is an orphan drug? Why is that important? And what happened here?
Well, theoretically, orphan drugs were established when a drug needed to be developed for a very small population of people and needed special expedited consideration, and it gets a tax break. And so Gilead had a drug already that it was proposing to repurpose for use on coronavirus. We don't know how effective it will be, but it wanted to extend its monopoly power even further. About the only good thing I can say about this is that there was a big outcry from universities allied for essential medicines by Public Citizen and other public interest groups, and Gilead had to reverse its outrageous course. This is very similar to the kind of problem we had with manufacturers of naloxone, something that is used by the fire department and first responders across Bexar County to deal with opioid overdose deaths. It seems to be that every time we have a crisis, Big Pharma sees it as an opportunity to jack up prices.
You have been singled out in some conservative media saying that you are calling for price controls on drugs related to treating coronavirus patients, and they are calling this socialism. So talk about that.
Yes. Well, my concern is that we have price controls right now. They're controlled by monopolies. Government-approved monopolies setting prices at whatever the sick or dying will pay are, in this case, all of us motivated by fear and concern for our family and friends because of the coronavirus pandemic that President Trump didn't take steps to prepare for. I think that it is not right to require people to pay unaffordable monopoly prices for essential drugs. And what I proposed a couple of years ago is that we use competition, American competition, to bring down prices if drug companies insist on using taxpayer-financed drugs to charge monopoly prices. So I don't think it's socialism. I think it's free enterprise, American competition. And those who most resist the whole concept of free enterprise and competition are drug companies like Gilead, who want to extend their monopoly power and exclude all competitors.
In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott has issued a number of executive decisions. Do you think that we should have a mandate telling people to shelter in place from the governor in order to flatten the curve of coronavirus cases?
Well, unfortunately, I think our choice is 6 feet apart or 6 feet under, and it really comes down to that. This governor, not unlike President Trump, has been reluctant to lead, though he certainly hasn't avoided publicity and press conferences. He failed to give guidance to our cities and our counties about when and how they should require shelter in place and social distancing. I admire the fact that Mayor Nirenberg, I saw his comments, his op-ed, referring to the shining, compassionate light of humanity in San Antonio. That's really important. But for those who don't have that shining light, we have to have some enforcement action. And the governor should have been doing this for the entire state. Every day our numbers climb and climb dramatically. And the only way we're going to get those numbers under control, because of Trump's failure to have adequate testing available, is if we engage in social distancing and try to prevent the death of more of our neighbors.
Do you think that had we had wide testing and a greater awareness of what the coronavirus looked like, what it could do, how it was spreading in the United States, that we would be in a different position than we are today and where we will be in 2 weeks, which is predicted to be horrifying?
That's right. Horrifying is exactly the word. And yes, we could have perhaps not prevented at all, but had significantly less deaths, less interference in our daily lives. This administration had a simulation available last year. They had it in October. They had intelligence reports in January. There were reports flowing out of China in December. There was plenty of information to act and act effectively to prevent this very kind of pandemic. And instead, we had the president calling it a Democratic hoax, saying it was no big deal. And as recently as this week, like the Easter Bunny, he's predicted that we would have a happy Easter and a lot of people could go back to work. This kind of false information, this kind of deception and denial has prevented us from getting the testing on the ground. The administration refused tests from the World Health Organization. We are testing a smaller percentage of people than South Korea did. It's now a race to try to catch up with other countries that did a better job of this, because we realize we've got more coronavirus infections than even China now, and this administration could have stopped and prevented most of them.
San Antonio Congressman Lloyd Doggett is the chairman of the House Ways and Means Subcommittee on Health. Doggett says the U.S. coronavirus crisis could have been avoided if widespread testing had been made available earlier and the White House hadn't wasted time calling the COVID-19 a Democratic hoax. In the midst of this global pandemic that has brought about school closures, college students don't just deal with it by watching video lectures or Skype meetings with their professors. They're carrying the burden of diminishing access to essential items, job losses, and other issues most might not realize. In her commentary, Texas Public Radio contributor Yvette Benavides shares her insights on troubling developments affecting students already facing the challenges of being in college.
When universities in San Antonio announced campus closures extending through early to mid-April and beyond, I considered what this would mean for the particular students I work with. They're undergraduate and graduate students. They range in age from about 18 to 65 and are from all walks of life. Most of them are what's known in higher education as first gen, first generation, the first in their families to go to college. I have students who are military veterans and single mothers. Some work one, two, or three jobs. Some are cancer survivors or suffer from mental illness. Some require accommodations provided for by the Americans with Disabilities Act. My students are future artists, accountants, doctors, scientists, teachers, social workers, speech pathologists. They are introverts, extroverts, athletes, actors, writers, and dreamers. They are all as wonderfully diverse as they can be. But now, in the midst of this global pandemic, every single student faces a horrifying equalizer, the same terrible obstacle to contend with. The necessary closure of a campus, for many of them, means a door closing, one that they'd finally somehow pried open at tremendous sacrifice and years of hard work. Some students are so much as homeless now. Some are back home sharing spaces with parents and siblings who might also need the only computer in the house to keep up with their own deadlines. Some now live in an abusive space they had managed to escape by living on campus. The students who are also parents have to take care of so many others. Some students take care of a chronically ill parent. Some are the sole breadwinners in the house or contribute heavily to the household income. Each of them has lost the structure, routine, and even sanctuary that a campus can provide. My students have shared with me that they've had to file for unemployment, might have to quit school, have little access to food. Some have shared they fear they'll never see their grandparents again. They share over and again their all-consuming fear of illness and death. In her essay, Unmothered, Ruth Margolit refers to the Hebrew word malkosh, which means last rains. She writes that the word has heavy significance in places like Israel, where seasons are defined, dividing a winter from a long stretch of a dry, hot summer. It's a word that's applied in retrospect. When it finally rains, you'll have no way of knowing if this is the last rain of the year. Eventually, when you realize that it was, you can refer to it as malkosh. You can look back and realize the last time was the last time, only in hindsight. Here's our own malkosh, our own last time we didn't know was the last time. For our students, it means the last time they could pull an all-nighter, write an essay, or complete a project with their peers, far away from the threat of the global pandemic. The waves of disruption and panic will continue over the next weeks and months. One day we will realize another moment of malkosh, when the heart-sinking fear no longer clouds every other thought, when we can grab a cup of coffee or a sandwich in the cafeteria without dread, when the campus becomes a sanctuary again, bustling and vibrant, all of us together again in those hallowed spaces. One day, we will all know together that the last time this blight cast a shadow on life as we knew it was, in fact, the last time.
Yvette Benavides is a professor of English and creative writing at Our Lady of the Lake University. She is the co-author of the book, San Antonio 365, published by Trinity University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our website at tpr.org, and that's where you can find past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.